from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to affirm that Venezuela is the second country in South America to receive migration and the country with the fewest volunteer migrants in the continent. The Venezuelan policies are of integration to the migratory flow and mainly for the displaced as a result of internal conflicts in Colombia, she said, remembering that currently 5,600,000 Colombians live in Venezuela. The Venezuelan vice president also noted that the United States had already disbursed $46 million to cover expenses run by countries in the region to respond to the supposed humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. She held Washington responsible for the media war against the South American nation. Reactions by the Venezuelan officials came as hundreds of Venezuelan nationals gathered at their embassy in Lima, Peru, requesting that the government of President Nicolas Maduro help them go back to their home country.
My little lady, dream till the sunrise.
Hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
We're supposed to stand up to discrimination. And we're sure as heck supposed to stand up clearly and unequivocally to Nazi sympathizers. How hard can that be, saying that Nazis are bad? I'll be honest. Sometimes I get into arguments with progressive friends about what the current political movement
is. Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man come in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet Radio for smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Hello, Bob.
President Trump, how are you?
How are you? How are you doing? Okay?
Real well. I'm turning on my tape recorder.
Oh, that's okay.
With your permission.
That's okay.
I'm sorry we missed the opportunity to talk for the book.
Well, I just spoke with Kellyanne, and she asked me if I got a call. I never got a call. I never got a message. Who did you ask about speaking to me?
Well, about six people.
They don't tell me.
Senator, I talked to Kellyanne about it 2.5 months ago. She came for lunch.
Well, it's too bad. Of course, you and I had a conversation, a couple of years ago, and so that, I think, got you there a little bit. And we had a conversation many years ago, if you remember, in Trump Tower.
I did.
That has to be 20 years ago. And you were thinking about doing a book about me then, which is interesting. Who knew it would have been on this subject, right?
Yeah,
that was not in the cards at that time.
That's right. Well, I'm sorry.
I still remember that.
I spent a lot of time on this, talked to lots of people.
All right, good.
And as you know and are living, we're at a pivot point in history.
Right.
And I would have liked to have done that, and I maximized my effort.
Right.
And somehow it didn't get to you, or
it's really too bad because nobody told me about it, and I would have loved to have spoken to you. You know, I'm very open to you. I think you've always been fair, but we'll see what happens. But all I can say is the country is doing very well. We're doing better economically, just about that at any time. We're doing better on unemployment, maybe than ever. You know, I mean, if you look at the unemployment numbers, you've heard me say it, and we're doing better on unemployment than just about ever. We're having a lot of companies are moving back into our country, which is would have been unheard of 2 years ago. If the other administration or representatives of it had kept going, or kept, you know, if the other group had won, I will tell you that you would have, I think you'd have a GDP of less than zero. I think we would have been going in the wrong direction because regulations are such a big part of what we've done, Bob.
Well, I understand that point of view, and as you know, it's also a difficult time where the political system and you and my business is being tested.
Yeah.
And I take it very seriously. I've done books on eight presidents going back from Nixon, Obama.
Right.
And I learned something about reporting, frankly, Mr. President.
Good.
I've got to go talk to people and see them outside of the White House and outside of their offices, and gained a lot of insight and documentation. And it's, it's a tough look at the world and your administration and you.
Right. Well, I assume that means it's going to be a negative book, but... Well, I'm sort of 50% used to that. That's all right. Some are good and some are bad. Sounds like this is going to be a bad one.
It's a chance missed, and I don't know how things work over there in terms
of getting
to you.
Well, if you would call Madeline in my office, did you speak to Madeline?
No, I didn't. But
Madeline is the key. She's the secret
because she's
the person.
I talked to Kelly.
Well, a lot of them are afraid to come and talk, or they are busy. I'm busy, but I don't mind talking to you. I would have spoken to you. I spoke to you 20 years ago. And I spoke to you a year and a half or 2 years ago. I certainly don't mind talking to you. And I wish I could have spoken to you.
Well,
but nobody called my office. I mean. You went through, different people.
Mr. President, how can I spend all this time talking to people and like Kellyanne and Raj and Republican senators? I mean...
Who were the senators? No, they never called me about it.
Senator Graham said he had talked to you about talking to me. Now, is that not true?
Senator Graham actually mentioned it quickly on one meeting.
Right.
And, that is true. That is true. Well, that is true. Mentioned it quickly, not like, And I would certainly have thought that maybe you would have called the office. But that's okay. I'll speak to Kellyanne. I am a little surprised that she wouldn't have told me. Yeah, in fact, well, she just walked in. I'm talking to Bob Woodward. He said that he told you about speaking to me, but you never told me. Why didn't you tell me? I would have been very happy to speak to him. All right, so what are you going to do?
Well,
so I have another bad book coming out.
It goes on, and, you know, I what you can count on is that I've been very careful. And Evelyn, are you on?
Yes.
Evelyn Duffy, who's my assistant, Mr.
Hello, Evelyn.
She transcribed all the tapes because, with permission, I tape people for hundreds of hours.
Good.
And I think there's nothing in this book that doesn't come from a first-hand source. Is that correct, Evelyn?
I believe.
But are you naming names, or do you just say sources?
Yeah, well, it names real incidents, so.
No, but do you name sources? I mean, are you naming the people, or just say, you know, people have said?
I say at 2 o'clock on this day, the following happened, and everyone who's there, including yourself, it is quoted. And I'm sorry I didn't get to ask you about these.
I mean, you do know I'm doing a great job for the country. You do know that NATO now is going to pay billions and billions of dollars more, as an example, than anybody thought possible, that other presidents were unable to get more, and it was heading downward. You do know all of the things I've done and things that I'm doing. I'm in the process of making some of the greatest trade deals ever to be made. You do understand that stuff. I hope.
I understand, and I would have loved to go through a discussion with you about NATO, because this, you know, goes back to early in your administration and your concern about it and the agreement that the countries have that they would increase their defense contribution, by the year 2024. And, you know, so anyway, we are...
Well, you know, last year, if you see the Secretary Stoltenberg, he said, I believe, $44 billion just last year, and that was from last year's meeting. And this year, it's much more money they've agreed to put up. So it's a tremendous amount of money. No other president has done it. It was heading down in the opposite direction, so I don't know if you're going to report it that way. Probably not, but it's too bad, but that's all right. But, you know, one of those things.
Everything is going to be factual, and it is not a good thing for my business, if I may say this to you, Mr. President, to the presidency or to the country, to not have real full exchanges on these. And I broke my spear on it trying to get to you.
Well, other than Lindsay, who did quickly mention it, nobody mentioned it. Nobody told me about it. Well, let me ask her. Why don't you speak to Kellyanne? Ask her. She never told me about it.
Kellyanne.
Bob, how are you? Hi.
I remember 2.5 months ago you came over and I laid out I wanted to talk to the president, and you said you would get back to me.
I do, and I put in the request. But, you know, it was rejected. I can only take it so far. I guess I can bring it right to the president next time. But I try to follow all the protocols, or else I'm accused of being somebody who doesn't follow protocol.
President Trump, I just want you to know I made every effort.
Did you? But you had talked to Hope, right, who said no?
Listen, I talked to anyone I could.
You talked to a number of people, and they all said no?
Raj, he was going to push it out.
Hope, me.
Yeah.
So you said you tried to talk to everybody. What about when you interviewed, like, yeah, other people?
Yeah.
They all said yes?
Yeah, well.
That they tried?
About 6 or 7 people I tried. And I couldn't have, you know, you and I spent a whole lunch on it, Kellyanne. And I said, I want to cover the substantive issues in foreign policy and domestic policy. And you said you would get back to me. Nothing.
Yeah, so I did. I presented it to the people here who make those decisions, but anyway, I'll give you back to the president, and I'm glad to hear that you tried through 7 or 8 different people.
Yeah.
That's good. You should tell him all the names. Thank you.
But you never called for me. It would have been nice, Bob, if you called for me at my office. I mean, I have a secretary. I have 2-3 secretaries. If you would have called directly, a lot of people are afraid that Raj, I hardly have, you know, I don't speak to Raj. I do. And Kellyanne went to somebody, but she didn't come to me. And she should have come to me. She does have access to me, absolutely. She has direct access, but she didn't come to me. And you know what? That's okay. I'll just end up with another bad book. What can I tell you?
It's surprising to me that these people, did Raj have access to you?
Not really, but he would have been able to do it. But I have an office. You have the office number. I have an office that's directly into my office. It doesn't matter. Let me tell you what matters. The economy is the best it's been in many, many decades, and it's going to get a lot better. And the country is doing very well. That's what's important.
Yes, sir. I thought
we're doing a good job.
Kind of say, let's not talk about this because the book is done.
Yeah, I know.
The president, but you know that's the position we're in, and it's one I tried to avoid. You need to know I made maximum effort.
All right, it's too bad.
Yes, sir.
I'm just hearing about it, and I heard I did hear from Lindsay, but I'm just hearing about it. So we're going to have a very inaccurate book, and that's too bad.
No,
but I don't blame you entirely.
Accurate.
All right, okay. Well, accurate is that nobody's ever done a better job than I'm doing as president. That I can tell you. So that's the way a lot of people feel that know what's going on, and you'll see that over the years. But a lot of people feel that, Bob. So
I believe in our country, and because you're our president, I wish you good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it. Bye.
Internet radio for smarter than
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Soliton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, late of Guatemala, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in unceded Chinook and Peoples Territories, North America. Depending on who you talk to, this show does or does not come from Indian country. That's always a discussion that can be had. I'm open to that discussion, frankly. You know, really, you know, because, you know, white Indians are accepted, you know, without having to prove any goddamn thing. If you're African native, you got to prove yourself. If you're Filipino and native and not in the Pacific Northwest, right, you have to prove yourself. You know, when I'm on the East Coast, I don't have to, you know, make an argument that I'm African and native, you know, and part Jewish. You know, I don't have to discuss anything because that's part of the mix. It's part of the melange over there. But on the East Coast and in the Midwest, well, goddamn, you know, I better have my AKC fucking pedigree card. I better have my white pedigree card. Because, you know, if you don't, you know, you can't be accepted, right? Because you're not real, right? You know, because you're not following in their idea. Until somebody from a well-known tribal family gets rejected. Until they get kicked out of their nation, legally speaking. And no, I'm not talking about the Black Cherokee in Oklahoma, you know, with Chad Smith. That's long over. The legalities of it anyway are long over. Lupe's saying I should mention why I'm bringing this up. Well, I'm bringing this up because I bumped into some black folks who are native, who said they just got back from Oklahoma. They went to visit their family in Oklahoma, but they said they went to a couple of, they said it was over the summer, right? Well, yes, yeah, it's September now, so summer's over. Labor Day has passed, so whatever it is. Some, you know, because the Cherokee don't powwow, right? So, you know, whatever cultural events that they went to over there, and I don't know exactly where they were. I mean, they told me, but I don't remember. You know, the Van family came up. For those of you who don't know, the Van family are a clan of Black Cherokee that have been legally fighting the nation for recognition for, you know, some time now. And, you know, after Stan Waddy and the Confederate bid, you know, I'm kind of, I don't give a fuck, you know. And yeah, and, you know, somebody has pointed that out too, because Lupe has pointed it out. We've talked about it here. Lupe's husband is Irish. And, what'd you say, good Irish? Well, that takes some explaining. But, the Irish independence, yeah. Yeah, but, in any case, you know, the whole question of identity, you know, where does it fit in? And yeah, you know, where does identity fit in? Because we have Colin Kaepernick, who, you know, is still getting lambasted in a lot of corners of Black America on whether or not he's really Black. And yeah, I still have a problem with it. I have a chip on my shoulder about it. And yeah, it fucks. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up, because, Tiger Woods, who was also, mixed race, biracial, what have you, he has stepped into this fray and has stood up, supporting, Kaepernick with this new ad with, is it Nike? Cause I don't, yeah, that's another thing. You know, we've been, and I really hate to start out these shows by saying, oh, well, you know, we apologize for not coming in here. We lost our studio. We lost our regular studio because of Trump, indirectly. And what I mean by that is that even though the owner of the studio, who was a, you know, American citizen, but he was born in Mexico. Well, what ended up happening was, I mean, we've talked about this. And I'll mention this briefly so that folks who are not regular understand what I'm talking about. Apparently, his wife, there was some kind of a loophole. And she hasn't been detained or anything yet. I haven't heard anything like that. I mean, have you heard anything like that? I haven't heard anything like that. But he closed the studio down because he really can't focus on it. You know, that was a major source of his income, was providing a way for the Spanish-speaking community, not just Mexicans here, to make commercials for radio programs and for whatever it is that they're doing, for ads, for radio programs. You know, that's what he did. You know, he did that in Mexico. He did it up here on top of his regular gig, which I understand something happened with that too, right, Luke? So, you know, we don't have any money. He doesn't have any money. So our regular studio setup is pretty much kaput. At least for right now, in the foreseeable future. But I don't think it's going to come back. I mean, this immigration shit has really fucked his family up. I mean, he hasn't talked to me about it that much. He's talked to you, but you guys were having a private conversation, and it was between you, okay? No, I respect that. I respect that. It's none of my business, you know. I mean, I would like to help him if I could. I don't know what I can do. You know, other than to talk about the fact that I think he's a solid cat. And, you know, and I've talked about this. He was kind of nervous about what we were doing around here. He's not a political person, and he was not particularly, you know, into that. He wasn't keen on that. But, he didn't figure we were doing anything that was wrong, so, you know, he brought us in here. And, yeah. He now has, effectively shut down operations. So, this may be the last broadcast that you hear, from this location. Any case, Lupe and I have to think of something else. You know, we've been in basements, we've set up, because really, I mean, we've talked about this, and I shouldn't go on any further about it, but if you have a microphone, you know, a decent microphone, if you have a headset microphone set up, you can record media on any modern computer. So basically, anybody can do media. But if you're going to do media, do media. If you're going to do news, do news. You know, don't do the Alex Jones bullshit. And I suppose that's one of the things we can go over to, because we don't want to be in here too long. If it wasn't for the fact that, you know, we knew that a lot of you were, you know, waiting for broadcasts, because I haven't heard anything, because I've been busy. I was in Montana for a little while and in Idaho. But Lupe said that people have said to her, you know, what's going on with the shows. And at first, it was because of the studio. And then I went out of town because we weren't able to record anyway. And, you know, I hadn't really posted too much. And again, you know, check us out. Now, you can check me out on Twitter anyway, at The Angry Indian. And you can check out our news feed, at Aboriginal Press. But in any case, I needed to take a break anyhow. You understand what I'm saying? And, you know, it took about a week, you know, being away from this bullshit, you know, not looking at politics, not looking at the news, to decompress for a little bit. But then, you know, I was in Montana and I was in Idaho. They're actually embarrassed. I spoke to quite a few people who I heard talking to other white folks who were saying, yeah, you know, he's fucking embarrassing. But then when I came around, you know, they had nothing but glowing things to say about Trump. And what it comes down to is they're embarrassed by Trump, just like we got this Nunez, who's Portuguese. I mean, you know, I suppose the Portuguese like to think they're white, you know, at least in the United States, you know, Spaniards, Portuguese. Well, the Spaniards are white, but I've spoken to Spaniards who Lupe have told me that they don't see Portuguese as white, you know, and they were pointing to Mozambique as one of the fucking reasons. So, you know, you can make up your own mind about that. You know, you got the whole Castiliano versus Indio versus fucking, Octoroon, Quadroon, Zombo. I mean, you can bring up all the fucking terms you want to in terms of mixed people, but yeah, you know, it is what the fuck it is, right? So, yeah, I needed to decompress, man. You know, I mean, and then when I did come in front of a, where was I? I was passing through Seattle. Stopped someplace to get coffee, because what the fuck else do you do in Seattle, right? And they had the Kavanaugh hearings, and I'm watching them beat the shit out of people to drag them out of this fucking hearing. You know, I'm like this. If you're a cop and you're, you know, actively, willingly, well, this is my job. Yeah, I got family, cops, fucking former FBI, former DIA, you know, I don't, what? Yeah, DIA and DEA. I mean, I keep trying to explain, folks, I do not come from a liberal family. You know, one half of my family was split in terms of, right? The other half was conservative black power. You know, and I was caught in the middle of that shit because of my mama. So, you know, try to imagine what the fuck my life was like. You know, and for my siblings and shit. You know, so, you know, we were caught between these two motherfucking worlds of conservatism. Alright? And I'm telling you, you know, I look at this, I'm listening to what's happening. And I don't know, you know, I'm just kind of done. You know, I know I said several dispatches ago, you know, I'm still in the fight. I am. But when I stop to get coffee and a goddamn biscotti at this place, and they're playing the Kavanaugh shit, and I'm watching police officers beat down people who are peacefully protesting, they were roughly, yeah, and at least one of those things, I swear that they fucking punched that man. And there was a woman that they knocked her against the wall and then threw her to the ground and then dragged her out. Several of them dragged her out. I'm like this. If you're a goddamn police officer in the fucking United States of America and you're going to willingly keep people, just like I feel the same way when I watch those loot in D.C., when I watch those disabled people be dragged off. when Trump first got in, they were being dragged off because they were talking about cutting the pre-existing conditions. See, I mean, this is something that affects a lot of the MAGA fuckers. I mean, when I go to the supermarket here, you know, all of these hover rounds and these goddamn, no, I'm not talking about Segways. I'm talking about hover rounds. You know, I can see the colostomy bags. You know, I mean, I was at Walmart, here in Oregon. I'm trying to remember where it was. We had to stop someplace to get some things. And somebody who was part of the group was like, oh, can I go to Walmart since we're here? Now, I hate strip malls to begin with. You know, but anyway, we went to this fucking Walmart. And yeah, I'm going to say this. And if you don't like it, too motherfucking bad. Everybody in there was fat. Everybody in there shuffled their fucking feet. Everybody in there looked unfucking healthy. Everybody fucking in there was about as unattractive as could goddamn be. And what I mean by that is they looked fucking unhealthy. But everybody was smug and had this attitude. Like every fifth or sixth person I saw had on an America shirt or some kind of MAGA or Trump like hat or t-shirt or some kind of bullshit. But these were the most unhealthy looking, obese, where you know that they are going to be going and begging at some goddamn point for help, for medical fucking help. Now, while I didn't hear anything stupid other than, like, you know, some ignorant statements, but, you know, nothing racial or what have you, but I'm looking at these folks, and they're looking at me because they got on their MAGA shit, right? And they're looking at me. And, you know, it's the type of thing that I've been saying for quite a while on this show and in my private life. You know, these goddamn baseball caps are ugly. These fucking shorts. You know, out here in the Pacific Northwest, I don't know what the fuck it is. You know, motherfuckers do not wear trousers and a proper pair of shoes and socks. They wear shorts everywhere. They wear trainers every fucking where. Baseball caps everywhere. Ill-fitting clothes. Terrible fucking posture. You look like shit. You eat shit. You got an attitude that is fucking horrible. And what makes it worse is, look in the fucking mirror while you're talking about how Mexicans are and what have you. And yes, I've got my fucking complaints. And this is where the left gets mad with me. Yeah, I've been very clear about this. I don't give a fuck about the ethnicity or the racial background or what have you. But I am going to say two fucking things. If you're going to live in a country, whether it's the United States or me as, you know, somebody who, primary language is English, if I'm going to go live in Rome, if I'm going to go live in Chile, if I'm going to live in, China, I need to learn to speak the fucking language. And, you know, you got people here who have been here 17, 20 some odd fucking years and still don't speak English. That's bullshit. That's ridiculous. Now, I'm not talking about you get into a cab, because this happened the last time I was in New York City, right? Hopped into a cab, and I couldn't understand the cat, and for whatever reason, he seemed like he couldn't understand me. Now, I didn't get into an argument with him about how long he had been in the country or whatever the fuck, but, you know, it made things difficult, and we kind of got heated with each other. It didn't get racial, because I wasn't going to let it go there, and he didn't go there, so there was no reason. You dig what I'm saying? And I'm saying it like that because there's a lot of black folks I'm watching get foul, man. You know, talking about, you know, motherfuckers need to learn to speak English who have been here like 5 minutes. Now, you know, somebody's been here from Nicaragua, Guatemala, whatever the fuck, because they're running from a human rights issue. And I mean, literally, they've been here like several days. You're really going to demand that they speak fucking English? And you're going to come up with some bullshit about when they teach English all over the world. Oh, not where the fuck they come from, man. They come from goddamn villages. They come from fucking barrios. They don't have any fucking more than you do. They got less. See, this is the type of shit that I'm saying. You know, if you're black and you're going to talk shit like that, why don't you talk, do what I do? Do what I do. Say that kind of shit to neo-Nazis. Challenge racists. Challenge motherfucking Uncle Toms. You know what I'm saying? You know, why the fuck are you, what was it, one of the main reasons we asked you, we were able, you know, that I wanted to talk about it anyway, coming in here today. Motherfucking some black cop. Where was it? I don't remember. And if you can find it, put it on the screen. But, yeah, he tased this 11-year-old girl. And now, this is a black cop who tased a black 11-year-old girl. Now, look, you know, I sit here and complain about black folks being out of pocket and using racism or, you know, I'm disadvantaged or whatever as an excuse. There's a big difference between doing that to get your ass out of trouble when you knew you were wrong. And apparently the girl was shoplifting, right? So the child, and I'm emphasizing child here, the child was shoplifting. But you're a grown motherfucking man with gray in your beard. You use a fucking taser on an 11-year-old that then is caught on film that they had to fucking remove the taser pins from the back of her neck. So not only did you tase an 11-year-old, you tased it in the fucking back. While we got black people out here being murdered by white police officers who are racist. And see, and here's the thing, because he then gave her a speech about how this is why we can't have department stores or some kind of shit, or we can't have restaurants in the black community because of people like you. I mean, I get the frustration. I get the frustration. But see, but this is where political ignorance fucking comes in. Because first off, this little fucking 11-year-old goddamn black girl wasn't thinking about none of that shit. You know, she probably just wanted something, and she decided she was going to fucking take it. Which is no different than what the fuck Scott Pruitt and the rest of them did. And I'm not excusing any fucking thing. I mean, I feel like I have to say this every goddamn episode. I get crashed by the black community for pointing out shit like this all the time. Now, if I was there, because I've done this, if I was there, I'd have been like, yo, what the fuck are you stealing for? You know what I mean? And if the mother thought, well, you don't have a right, you know, my mother, that child, that, look, you know, your kids shouldn't be fucking stealing. But at the same goddamn time, you're a black fucking cop. There wasn't a better way you could fucking deal with that. You couldn't have apprehended her. Of course she tried to get away. She's 11 fucking years old. Of course she tried to get away. Okay, so you had to taser her because she... So basically she was running and you shot her in the fucking back. An 11-year-old. Over some material, over some property that wasn't even fucking yours. And you're ready to go the extra goddamn mile. Now my question is for that black cop. Black cop, black cop, black cop. Black cop, black cop, black cop, right? Would you do that shit to a fucking neo-Nazi? I got a piece of bone or cartilage, right? Because there's really no bone up here. But cartilage. My nose was rearranged by a neo-Nazi going on almost 2 decades now, right? My nose was rearranged by this motherfucker. He sat on me and beat me bloody. Yeah, I don't look the same. I haven't looked the same since that day, right? So, you know, motherfucking, here it is. You got these, you know, these middle class black cats talking all this shit. You know, you niggas are the reason why we don't have anything. Because I demand a Starbucks. I demand to have a strip mall in the middle of the fucking hood, you know. I demand all this shit. And you're the reason I can't get it. You're the reason I can't fucking have it. I mean, like I said, I come from a family of black conservatives that go extreme white to extreme black. And, you know, in the middle, you know, in this particular political fucking time frame, to be saying, let alone doing some bullshit like that, is not just an embarrassment. It's not just a violation of the human rights of this fucking... I mean, this political fucking ignorance. I mean, that's all the fuck it is to it. And I feel bad. And this is one of the reasons why I didn't want to come in here. Because, you know, I come in and then it's like, okay, well, you know, the past several episodes, they go, no, all you're doing is ragging black people. And it's like, but what are we doing? You know, when I got people coming up to me, you know, white folks, quoting Paris Dinard, quoting Diamond and Silk, right? And then the last broadcast, quoting Scotty Reed with his misfucking information. Or if they consider themselves to be radical and shit, they either quote Alex Jones, who it took, you know, Twitter more than a fucking month to kick him off the fucking network, or they're talking, I got black people who are defending Ron and Rand Paul to me, which is why I mentioned Scotty Reed the last time. You know, Scotty Reed believes that liberals are responsible for neoliberalism. He believes that the liberals need to leave Trump alone. You talk about racism every now and again, but how can you be talking about racism when you're back in Ron and Rand Paul? And then what was it I saw today from, I've been telling y'all for a while that Glenn Greenwald, he's not black, right? So I guess it's okay. Black people will not get mad if I mention him. He did a post not too long ago on Twitter that says, the irony in the op-ed for the NYT's anonymous White House coward is glaring and massive. He accuses Trump of being anti-democratic while boasting of membership in an unelected cabal that covertly imposes their own ideology with zero democratic accountability, mandate, or transparency. What the fuck is Glenn Greenwald talking about? Is he talking about Trump? Or is he talking about whoever the fuck it is in the White House that said this shit? And what is it with calling this guy a person, whoever the fuck they are, regardless of gender, because this republic is right, so you can only be male or female with them. Calling this person a coward. Why? They're fucking Republicans. Whoever it is a Republican. They're a MAGA head. Why are you fucking surprised? How are they a coward? What they're saying is they want all of the white supremacy. They want all of the motherfucking getting rid of all of the regulations. They don't want to pay any motherfucking taxes. They're okay with the wall. They're okay with these parents being separated from their children. They're okay with all of it. They just don't want him to be bullish. They just don't want to be embarrassed by him. You know, they don't give a fuck about the rest of this shit. The North Korea deal, those of us who fucking have been paying attention for quite some goddamn time and have a certain modicum of Cartesian common sense knew full goddamn well that the Korean fucking deal was never a fucking deal. There was no Korean deal. There was never a Korean deal. And if you believe that there was a Korean deal, you're a fucking idiot. I mean, there must be a bridge someplace. Is it where all the hipsters go? Brooklyn, right? Yeah, so, you know, there must be a bridge over there for you someplace to buy, because there's no goddamn way. No motherfucking way you could be serious and have any common sense and think that anything that's going on right now is okay. And, you know, there's a bunch of black folks out here, and I'm not just talking about Pastor Mark, you know, Mark Burns or... You know, I know. I'm picking on Paris Denard, you know, whatever. You know, Glenn Greenwald is back and forth to Russia all the time. Why is that? Why are they letting him in and out like that? Why is he able to even, why is Democracy Now even still talking to him? Obviously, he's in with whatever the fuck the Russians are doing. Come on now. You know, the same thing with Snowden. I mean, he's still living there, right? And Assange is working with the Russians. He's been working with Daniel Rohrabacher. You know, I mean, Steven Seagal is caught up in this shit, too. You know, they're all fucking Trump people. I mean, how the fuck is the person in the White House, whoever did this op-ed that the New York Times, with common sense, posted anonymously, and they did it anonymously because this is exactly the fucking response that they knew was going to happen. I mean, look, they've been posting people who have been, making light of neo-Nazism and white supremacy and what have you. So it shouldn't surprise any goddamn buddy that they would have somebody come up and give a anonymous editorial. I mean, we're living in times when people have to work anonymously. You know, Trump is out here saying that Antifa is going to kill evangelicals, that Antifa is going to do violence, that the anti-fascist movement is actually what's bringing the country down. Not the fact that neo-Nazis are out here killing cops. Not the fact that neo-Nazis are going around here murdering people like they did at the Charlottesville event with Heather Heyer. You know, or that they tried to burn the goddamn church down the night before. You know, not the fact that they're walking to the AME church, you know, I'm talking about Dylan Roof right now, and kill a bunch of people while they're praying. You know, that, let's not, you know, let's just ignore that. Let's ignore, you know, Frayne. Let's ignore all of these white supremacists, all these anti-government fucks that have been running around doing all this goddamn damage. And we're going to really put our focus on the anti-fascists who are trying to stop them. You know, one side is walking around with torches in the middle of the fucking night talking about Jews will not replace us and it's time to turn on the ovens. The other side is saying that this country belongs to all of us. And, you know, I mean, I've recently got into it, you know, and I know people think I'm picking on Asian women too, but there just seems to be a thing out here in the Pacific Northwest that if you're Asian and you're female and you got a white husband or a white boyfriend, that somehow you're exempt from what the fuck is happening to the rest of us. That somehow the racism does not affect you, that the racism will never come to you. It will never cross your lawn. Who are out here saying that the neo-Nazis are not the problem, that the people who are actually fucking protesting against them are the violent sons of bitches that need to be locked up. And when I point out to them how many motherfucking neo-Nazi, how many fucking white supremacists, I mean, right here in Portland, we had a man who was run down. He moved here to live with his family. He was under 19, he was 19 or something, right, Lou? He was run down by white supremacists who just got out of prison like not even a week fucking before. He hadn't even been out a full fucking week, and he decided with his wife that he was going to take his goddamn pickup truck and cross the Meridian and mow this young man down. He had just come to motherfucking town. And he murdered this kid. He didn't even give him a chance to fuck up. But this is somebody who just got the fuck out of the goddamn joint here. And I got to argue with two fucking Japanese women talking about, yeah, well, you know, the real problem are the Antifa, because, you know, they're violent. And it's like, but the Nazis right here fucking killing people and talking about killing more people. They got books and TV shows about killing people. You know, because they're all pro-cop, right? They're killing cops out here. They're murdering police officers. They threaten to murder police officers. They threaten to turn over the United States goddamn government. I've written, what was the name of that piece? Luke, the one I was talking about how they were, right after Charlottesville, the motherfucker that runs the Daily Stormer, he said, we are at war with the United States. Has the Trump administration done anything about this? Has the Justice Department done anything about this? No, they're focused on Antifa, which is not a group. It's anybody that stands up against fucking fascism. So now that Obama has finally gotten up off his fucking ass in retirement to say what he should have said when he was in office, how much effort does it take to say that Nazis are bad? In reference to Trump. You know, he should have said this shit when he was in office. And if we're going to criticize him for being an Uncle fucking Tom. And I'm saying this because I'm in a position to say this. To where you were in a position to actually make a motherfucking change and do something and you didn't. Because you were worried about losing white fucking liberal support. Because the white people who did not goddamn, I mean, we can talk about Jill Stein all fucking day. And yeah, she did take a certain amount of fucking votes away. But let's be honest. The fucking people who figured that Jill Stein couldn't get in, and if they realized that they couldn't get fucking Sanders, they voted for Trump. We know this. It's not a secret. It's not a shock to anybody. We all know that those white liberals who consider themselves to be liberal, that once they realized that they couldn't get Sanders, that they're just like, well, fuck it, I vote for Trump. Because they're okay with the white supremacy bit. They're okay with the racism. They're okay with Steve Bannon. They're okay with Stephen Miller. They're okay with all of it. But the whole point about that fucking editorial in the New York Times was that there are some people that are simply embarrassed by the fact that they know that Trump is crooked. They want what he's pushing for. This is why they supported him in the first place. They want all of that, but they're afraid of the fallout. They're afraid of fucking what's going to happen now because of the door that they opened. And the door that they goddamn opened was anybody now can come up here talking any kind of crazy shit and be supported by people like fucking David Duke and not have to apologize for anything. I mean, he's upset with David Woodward, right? Now, we can get on David Woodward for not... I mean, sorry, Bob Woodward. I'm fucking tired. We can get on Bob Woodward for not saying certain things or whatever. But look, he's a journalist, and he has to maintain his position down there in D.C., and he's got to be sure about every fucking thing that he prints. You know, it's not like me making a retraction or something, and I've done that. But, you know, in his case... He loses access if he makes a slight mistake. And he basically said, yeah, this motherfucker, you know, they had a mock trial, a mock hearing session, because, you know, he's been running. Giuliani, who was his new lawyer, they've been running for Mueller, talking about, oh, well, you know, perjury trap. What the fuck is a perjury trap? They ask you a question, you fucking answer it. If you lie, if you perjure yourself, you fucking perjure yourself. What the fuck is a perjury trap? So they've just been making up shit as they go along. But, you know, what it's come down to is that, you know, I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated, and I'm frustrated with the fact that so many fucking people out here are simply saying they don't know what the fuck to do. When if it was Obama, they would have known exactly what the fuck to do. When Clinton was in and Kavanaugh was trying to get him to show his penis and shit to the goddamn court, they knew exactly what to do. Kavanaugh's a fucking liar. And you know, Trump, who refuses to show his taxes, but is talking about transparency. He's pushing QAnon, but talking about unnamed sources. You know, what the fuck is it with Melania? You know, be best Melania, but she can't seem to say anything about be best or about decency when it comes to her husband or anybody else in the GOP. And then you got people on the Republican end who are still trying to defer to a first lady. They can't say anything about the president insulting people racially, calling people animals, using Pocahontas. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I apologize to everybody for not coming in here, but it's like, what the fuck? I am preaching to the goddamn choir. What am I going to say? What am I going to say that you already don't know, that you already have not heard? The Nazis are taking the fuck over. And a lot of us are helping them on the idea that, well, you know, if I help these motherfuckers, and yeah, that's where I'm putting Scotty Reed, and that's where I'm putting Black Agenda Report. Yeah, I am. Because, you know, they're playing along with this shit. There's one thing to say that, because Kincaid did this to me. Kincaid did this to me on fucking Twitter, which is really the main reason I'm not dealing with him anymore. Because I had reposted Anna Navarro, the Nicaraguan, who's a Republican Party member, who's been stomping a fucking mud hole in Trump every chance she gets. Is she a Republican? Yes. Is she a conservative? Yes. Do I disagree with her on a whole lot of shit? Tons. Is she correct when she says what she says about Trump? Yes. So if I repost something that she said that's correct, how the fuck does that be? Oh, well, you're reposting Anna Navarro. Well, you've been giving a fucking pass to how many goddamn white fucking Democrats who can't come out of the fucking, you know, come out and say, yeah, Trump's a fucking racist. Now, I know if he's listening to this or anybody else who's doing, I still listen to him. Well, you know, what is Angry talking about? Well, go back into the fucking archives and listen to the times I've been on the show and the times that we've argued on the fucking show, on his program. And you'll see what the fuck I'm saying. What I mean by giving a pass is by this is what they're doing now. Feinstein, Steinstein, I don't know what it is on this side of the pond, they're still not fucking calling Trump a racist. Still, Senator Grassley, what the fuck is he doing? Schumer, what is he doing? You know, I mean, he will get up and defend fucking the genocide of Palestinians and shit, right? He'll defend Israel, but he can't say anything about the fucking neo-Nazis right under his goddamn nose. Same thing about the fucking ADL. I'm a Jew too. I can fucking say this. Where is the ADL when it comes to standing against the goddamn Trump administration and fuckers like Stephen Miller? Or Steve Bannon? Or Trump calling people animals? Or using Pocahontas? Even when he says shit about Jews, they don't say any goddamn thing. The fact that David Duke is still fucking... That white farmer nonsense? That meme that he's been pushing? The white racist meme out of South Africa that Trump and the GOP, Stephen Bannon, and these fuckers have been pushing all over Europe? It's a lie. It's a lie. We can talk about Terblanc, right? Eugene Terblanc, who was chopped up by machetes by two of his employees, who apparently he had been raping for fucking several years. Yeah, we can talk about that. Yeah, Eugene Terblanc was a homosexual who was taking advantage of his goddamn black employees. Because the racism allowed him to do that. Has nothing to do with his sexuality. The racism allowed him to do that. You don't even hear these white power motherfuckers talking about Eugene Terblanc any goddamn more. Now that they've had to accept the fact that he was homosexual, they don't want to deal with him. I mean, fuck, they still don't even want to deal with the fact that Adolf Hitler was goddamn gay. Well, let this just say homosexual, because there's really nothing gay about fucking Adolf Hitler, okay? Or Ernst Röhm or any of those fucking guys. But yeah, you know, they were men who liked other men. And, you know, the fact that they sent other homosexuals and shit to the camps, the fact that they sent homosexuals to their deaths doesn't mean a goddamn thing. You know, you can be black and fucking, you know, still turn in your brothers. I mean, black slave catchers were just that. Black fucking slave catchers, right? Boss niggas were just that. They were boss niggas. I mean, what do you think happened in the goddamn camps, man? I mean, do you think they had Germans and Poles or whatever the fuck, or Croatians and shit watching that? A lot of the fucking people who were doing the security were other Jews. What do you think goes on in the prison system now? What do you think went on in fucking Angola when all that shit broke out? I mean, it's still happening down there, I'm sure. But some of you know what I'm talking about. The fucking prisoners were running the system on behalf of the prison staff. You know, for access to a woman, for access to liquor, for access to marijuana, for access to heroin, for access to cocaine, whatever the fuck it is they were hooked up to on the street. Come on, man. We're selling each other the fuck out. We're selling ourselves out. We all goddamn know that Trump is fucking impeachable. But is anybody supporting James Brown in Texas? No. Is the black community supporting him? No. Is Obama supporting him? No. Is Kamala Harris supporting him? No. So then what the fuck is the point of me doing these broadcasts? If you're not going to get up off your ass and get political, and start doing something. Stop talking shit and stop doing something. You know, we got a bunch of hoteps out here. They got all that kente cloth and all that bullshit. They're just trying to be a fucking king in their own little fucking fiefdom. These motherfuckers will never be worth anything beyond their own motherfucking neighborhood. But for those of you who want something tangible, who understand that socialism, you know, you want to quote Malcolm X all the time. He said, socialism's taking over Africa for a fucking reason. Alright, you know, we need to be doing that kind of goddamn research. That kind of fucking study. Fuck the quotes. Do the work. And don't want to take credit for Copernic now when you've been talking shit about him. Just yesterday I heard motherfuckers talking about Copernic ain't a real nigga. He ain't a real nigga. You know, because if you did, you wouldn't get excited by the fucking fact that Colin Copernic got picked up by Nike. Nike, the head of Nike just gave money to a Republican here in Oregon to make sure that the Republican Trump supporter gets back in office. Nike is just doing this shit as a marketing ploy for the NFL to make some money off of fucking black folks who are asleep. That's right, my Uncle Tom said it to you, brother and sister. You're asleep. You're asleep. You're letting this shit go. You're asleep. You fucking got all wrapped up around goddamn Black Panther. Yeah, I finally got a chance to see it, right? Went over to my buddy's house because it's already on Netflix. The shit just came out. It's already on Netflix. And I watched it. And, you know, everybody was doing all this Wakanda Forever bullshit. Wakanda Forever. Yeah, okay. Well, Wakanda Forever got you where the fuck you are right goddamn now. Nowhere. Black Lives Matter came and fucking went. Made a bid to hook up with the Clintons, and it fucking failed. You could have went with and supported Sanders, who was still out here doing something. But no, you can't do that. Because he's an old white Jew, so you couldn't do that. You know, some Illuminati bullshit, some QAnon bullshit. You know, I mean, this QAnon fucker here sets fire in California, creates the holy fire. And none of that shit is being held against the conservatives and these rabid fucks that they're dealing with. But on the other hand, Antifa is the big motherfucking problem, right? So, you know, I'm done for right now. It might be another week, right, Luke, before we're able to be set up on another show. Because we're not... He says he's closing down, right? That this is the last week. So, you know, either it'll be, you know, we'll do something. Believe that, you know. We'll do something. Yeah, so, you know, I'm the Angry Indian. And you can listen to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. And I hate to leave on a negative note, but, you know, we're going to continue with this conversation. It just may not be from this location. All right, but, you know, we're definitely going to continue this conversation because I'm not going to motherfucking stop. But, yeah, black folks, black men and women, get up off your ass, please. You know, if not for your own fucking sake, then for the black person next to you, you know, for the Native American next to you, you know, for whether they speak Spanish or English, you understand what I'm saying? You know, for the person, for the human being next to you, man, because this cannot continue to go on like this. You know, and I keep saying, yeah, the tide is high and all that kind of shit. But, you know, really, the fact that the Kavanaugh hearings are even going shows that the Democratic Party is fucking weak. After Merrick Garland, I mean, how the fuck could you allow them to do this? So basically, the DNC is allowing themselves to be bullied in one sense. And then in the other sense, they're scared to turn off their white fucking constituents, because they're afraid if they actually stand up and deal with fucking what we're looking at, they're going to turn these people off and they're going to go to Trump. Well, if they're going to go to Trump anyway, then that means that's what the fuck the country was about to fucking begin with. So there's your homework. This is the Angry Indian, and you are still listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Yes, Sinclair Skinner. You can find me at SinclairSkinner.com. Twitter at Skinner Liberated. That's Skinner, LIBER, the number 8ED. And you found me on Aboriginal Radio.
And the first word she heard was the word cunt. And she said, is it going to continue? And it only got worse. Is that right, Katie?
He gets the nomination, they're going to sue his ass off. We'll beat the shit out of them.
They're ripping the shit out of the sea. Going to knock the shit out of them.
Whoever the hell bought this mic system, don't pay the son of a bitch to put it in, I'll tell you. You shouldn't pay the bastard.
But it's political bullshit.
She said he's a pussy.
And you can tell them to go themselves.
You're not going to raise that fucking price, you understand?
Listen, you motherfuckers,
we're that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out, he's fired.
I wish she was a bitch. I don't care if she's a lovely
said
woman.
A terrible thing. You know what she said? Shout it out, because I don't want to... She said...
Problem.
I'm not sure I can trust him. Feel the heat, so I gotta say that I can only go by what I see. This Uncle Tom says you're his buddy. So what kind of witness does that make you for me?
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the angry Indian on intelligent Aboriginal radio. The podcast for intelligent Aboriginals.
Please note, if you experience difficulty with a cassette, please hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, call the customer service number shown on the package for a replacement. Discard the broken cassette.
This is the sound of a walking time bomb, fashioned from explosives, fuse, detonator, flesh, and blood. He is determined to commit the most awesome assassination of our time. Rod Steiger is Hennessy, the most dangerous man alive. Lee Remick is the woman who loves him. Hennessy, a fictional story so frighteningly authentic it was banned throughout the United Kingdom. Hennessy from American International, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I'm Asada Shakur. The first time I heard a tape of one of Mamiya's radio broadcasts, it was the first time I fully understood why the United States government was so intent on putting him to death. I make a special appeal to you, sisters and brothers, to fight tooth and nail to save Mamiya's life and to free him from the grips of his oppressors. As you honor our forefathers and foremothers, I urge you to honor our living heroes. When you honor the names of Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman, and Malcolm X, I urge you to honor the names of Geronimo Gijaga, Sundiata Okoli, Mutulu Shakur, and Mumia Abu-Jamal. I urge you not to forget and not to betray our living heroes. If we ignore their struggle, we are ignoring our own. If we betray our living history, then we are betraying ourselves. We could not save Malcolm X, but we can save Mamiya. We can save him, and we must save him. Because we love our brother, and we need our brother to help us fight for freedom. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, free all political prisoners. Let us carry on our tradition to freedom.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian Health Service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 99.7 en FM.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice. End HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination. Get information from your community health center or nursing station, or visit www.caan.ca.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
बता के नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अब इसकी क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप। ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। चल समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Millions of innocent people lost their lives because of the bigotry and Hitlerism that permeated Germany and other parts of the world. It was an obscene period in our nation's history. No, not our nation's, but in World War II. I mean, we all lived in this century. I didn't live in this century, but in this century's history. We did not have, matter of fact, we fought Hitlerism, which was a totalitarian form of government.
Tonight.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
We've had showers maybe twice within the 24 days that we have been locked down. We've just now been able to have an hour out, which is, this is my second time to have an hour out in this week's cycle. So as far as everything else is concerned, staff pretty much is, we've had staff that have been here from other facilities. They've been here with it's the SWORD team, the Special Operations Response Team. They've been here with automatic weapons, several K-9s and so forth, inside of the cell blocks. And then when they took us down to the gymnasium after they actually strip searched us to search our cells, they took us down there. They had us sitting in seats and so forth, but they had us surrounded with automatic weapons and these K-9s walking in between us and so forth. We've got guys who are sitting here for over 3 weeks now who've been brought into the cell block. No clothes, no underwear, no clean clothes, nothing. They have no property or anything. And they've been asking staff about this stuff, and they basically just been blowing them off. So they've created a humanitarian crisis, which is going on in here right now. So for the 20 days that we had been long locked up, we hadn't been out of our cell at all, period.
Wow. Okay. So you were locked in your cell for 20 days straight.
And they had the deputy commissioner, he came in. I was the one that initiated with him, Deputy Commissioner Reiser. Hey, look, we need indigent, since you guys have suspended our canteen and we can't go to canteen or anything like that, you have to supply us with envelopes and indigent supplies. And so they said they were going to have a meeting, and then when they had their meeting, all of a sudden they came out with a little small bag with envelopes, a little bit of soap, and some things in the indigent bag. And that was this past Monday. So after that, we haven't had anything since the 18th.
Wow. You think if people in prison were involved in figuring out how to make the prison safer, how to improve conditions, or how to, you know, make things work, that would improve things?
Yes, it would, because I remember, I've been down 21 years, and in the past, we had these things occur way back in, I can remember back in 90, from 98 on up. It was when they changed things over to when MENCOR started taking over, and the DOC actually really started getting into this for-profit situation, you know, a lot more in depth, that they started to back off and do this 100% staffing, whereas the prisoners didn't matter, and whatever the staff says, that's what goes. And when they created that wedge, everything started to change. The behavior, the way things were conducted within the prison system had changed because they left us out of all of the conversations. And now this is the result and the fruit of that labor. So now no one has a trust for staff. There's no relationship between us and staff anymore. So now when things do occur, nobody wants to talk to them about anything. So we just need people to want to be able to now step up, which I'm one of those people who really want to step up and have those conversations and build another bridge. But it's got to be with people, staff that we trust, and people who are willing to move forward with us and not against us.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Probably $500 billion a year is being spent on incarceration, arrest, the detention, probation, parole, the court system that processes these people. That's not even taking into account the lost productivity associated with them being unable to work.
Professor Ernest Drucker of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health joins us to talk about his new book, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. Since 1973, he writes, there has been a 1,733% increase in the numbers of Americans incarcerated over just drug charges. The inmate population is soaring, and Ernest Drucker reveals the damage to both inmates and their families, as well as to society as a whole. Professor Ernest Drucker, welcome.
Hello.
I want to ask you first about this 1,733% increase of arrests on drug charges. It's a phenomenal number. I mean, we're headed toward an increase of 2,000 in the coming decade, unless policy just towards drugs alone changes. And I mean, you write across the board of all of the explosions in arrests for various crimes.
We're seeing the effects of drug laws put into place beginning in the 70s, the mid-70s, starting with the Rockefeller drug laws in New York State, which really lowered the bar for incarcerating people arrested for drug use. I mean, these large numbers that are involved clearly are drug users, not kingpins or anything like that. And because the way the system is set up, where once you get into it, you are kind of sucked into it for life. In most cases, getting rearrested, if it's a drug problem, a drug addiction problem especially, obviously it goes on and it recurs. And the way the sentencing works is that if you get arrested again for the same charge, you get a heavier sentence. So that's tended to pile up the number of people coming into prison. And it's really about the drugs, and that's the point of my book, The Plague of Prisons, is that an epidemic of incarceration was launched by these drug laws, and it continues to this day.
And so in some ways, you've flipped the conversation on its head, where, for instance, you've argued against this idea that marijuana use leads to crime or leads to harder drug use by saying that actually it's incarceration for marijuana that leads to profoundly higher rates of incarceration. Just explain that example for us.
First of all, marijuana, the use of marijuana is some multiple, 5-10 times greater than the use of all the other illicit drugs combined. And marijuana arrests are a very big part of the feeder into this system and have been for the last 30 years. There's been some changes in New York recently reducing that, which I can speak about later. But certainly for that which filled up our prisons and led to a tenfold expansion of prisons, what I call mass incarceration, it begins with the war on drugs, basically, in the 70s.
Mass incarceration still, you write, is but a marginal political issue at best. And how much does that lack of political interest or will have to do with this ongoing problem?
It's marginal in the sense that you haven't heard the word drugs in this current political campaign. I haven't. It's not on the screen because politicians have learned that they go to this issue at their peril. They've called it the third rail of politics, touch it and you die. Because no matter what you say, you're wrong. If you want to modify these proposals, you're soft on crime and soft on drugs. If you want to make them harsher, you're really not speaking to an interest that people have right now. In fact, the whole issue, although we have more people in prison than for drug offenses in the United States than they have in prison for all offenses in the European Union, which has 100 million more people than we do, it's simply not an issue for politicians, the idea of very high rates of incarceration. It's not even seen as a problem. It's kind of an invisible problem. But there are 2 million people behind bars, and often the way into that system begins in youth with drug offenses. So people who are in the prisons because of drugs at first may go in later for other offenses, especially if they come out and they go back to using and selling drugs and they get rearrested again and begin to serve more time, they quite rapidly lose their connections to non-drug associates, friends, networks in the communities they come from. They're alienated from their families. They get pushed out of that social network that might give them another line in life, and they get more and more likely to be involved in drugs, and crime related to drugs, and often with violence related to drugs. Not that the drugs cause you to be violent, but the drug trade is a very violent trade.
Is your field of public health coming around to sort of understanding this in the same way they ultimately began to look at AIDS differently, for example?
Well, it's interesting you mention AIDS because AIDS, in fact, was what gave these ideas traction about drugs. Because I worked myself for 20 years in the Bronx running a drug treatment program that started before the AIDS epidemic. I started in the late 60s, early 70s, working with heroin addicts. And by the 80s, when AIDS arrived on the scene, I had 1,000 patients in treatment in 3 clinics in the Bronx. And when by the mid-80s, we had a test for HIV, we were able to see that half of them were already infected with AIDS. And so the drug program became an AIDS program. And that brought a lot of attention to the drug issue as a public health issue. It always had been one, but suddenly it was recognized by more people as that because of their fears of AIDS. There were certainly fears about drugs, especially on the part of white middle-class parents, as in the 60s and 70s. And that had played out as the stimulus for the war on drugs, which became politically very important in the 70s and 80s. There was some period was the election of Dukakis versus Bush Sr. It was seen as one of the leading problems the country faced. And now it doesn't even make the top 10 list anymore, even though there's plenty of drug use. There's plenty of problems with drugs. So the politics of it are very important. But the public health aspect has become more and more apparent, first with AIDS and with hepatitis, sexually transmitted diseases. All of those things cluster around not drugs per se, but drug prohibition. Because then what we're talking about here is a situation where the drugs themselves are inseparable from the policies meant to control them. Prohibition policies, same as alcohol prohibition.
This epidemic of incarceration is causing a different kind of public health problem for all of America, all of the world, that's not being looked at. And so that's economic, but it's also a social problem of incredible proportions, right? Why don't you explain how you see it pretty much in the reverse of some of those arguing on the law and order platform?
Well, I guess the reversal takes place by saying that it's not that crime and public safety are not important issues that we have to pay attention to, but they have a life of their own. Crime rates are among the lowest in recent history now, despite the fact that we have more people in prison than we've ever had. And some people said, oh, that's why the crime rates are low, because we have so many bad guys, quote, locked away. But in fact, there are many, many more former prisoners and formerly people who were formerly locked up, even for serious crimes, than there are currently in prison. That's always true. And when you look at the problem that is represented by imprisoning people for long periods of time, as opposed to the problem of crime, you understand it's a much bigger problem than crime, certainly now where crime is low. And I say that because the effects of imprisonment are not just to make the prisoner unhappy, and we can say a bit more later about the way in which they become incapacitated for competing in the world after their release, the issue of reentry, where the solution to this problem lies, I think. But what happens is that the effects of their being in prison always affect many other people. These are not people who are, you know, solos, who have no connectedness to children, brothers, sisters, wives, mothers. They're part of family networks like we all are. And the effect of imprisonment and then coming out of prison as damaged goods has very, very deleterious effects on the families that these people are chosen from, especially since the people who go to prison come from a very, very specific segment of society. They're poor, they're minorities, they're concentrated in urban areas, such that you really wreak havoc with entire social networks. We did a study in the Lower East Side of Manhattan about 10 years ago looking at the people coming out of prison and jail following drug sentences and returning to their homes in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And what we did is we asked, with Ricardo Barreras, my colleague, we asked about, well, who else in the family has been in jail? Who else has been arrested? Who else has drug problems? Who else has problems with AIDS? And it was remarkable that once you identified one person like this, you discovered that the family network was full of them. Two, three, four other people in their family had been to prison. Almost 50% of these families had someone who had AIDS already, even 10 years ago. And the recurrence of this, the likelihood of going back to prison after you get out, is over 50% in 3 years. So you begin to have patterns where people go off to prison, they come back, someone else in the family goes off. It's a constant drumbeat of this. And that destabilizes the social networks, the support networks, especially of poor people who rely on those networks. God knows they can't rely on the government. They rely on those networks to help each other. And those are really seriously affected. There's another dimension that's even more ominous, and that is the actual life expectancy of the people involved, especially children. Chris Wildman, who's a young sociology professor at Yale up near you, did a study looking at infant mortality, death of children before the age of one, among parents who had been in prison and those who had a household that their parent had been in prison, as opposed to households where a parent hadn't been in prison. And the infant mortality rate for the children of prisoners was 25% of all the infant deaths were associated with imprisonment.
I was just floored by some of what you wrote because, for example, you know, I had thought of this argument about, you know, how incarceration affects families and in particular children as looking at something that's generated within the family itself. But if you have a parent in prison, you're less likely to get a job, right? I mean, you might
Absolutely.
Be shunned by society, literally, which makes it much more likely that you're going to lead a sad life that could result in arrest.
And if you view the person who goes to prison as a member of a family or community, you damage them in serious ways around fundamental things. Their ability to vote is lost. The six states still take away the vote if you've ever got a felony offense. You can't get licenses for jobs like being a beautician or a cab driver. You can't get educational loans or home loans. If your family lives in public housing, a housing project, you're not allowed to be on the premises of those buildings or you jeopardize your grandmother's apartment, things like that. So you have this problem after problem that's imposed on the person, all of which seem designed to make sure they can't live anywhere but in prison.
You know, one wonders at times if you're really writing about America. You know, it's interesting this morning we heard about laws under consideration still and being discussed about women's rights in Afghanistan. But you're really talking about the way the U.S. government imposes this on the whole society at large, and basically people are stuck with it. I mean, if their children are being stigmatized and discriminated against, we're punishing a much wider group of people.
It's worse than stigma. I see. It's very easy to think of someone who's been called a criminal and been put in prison as a bad person, and it's just as well that they're separated from their children. But it turns out that if you talk to the children, their father went off one day and didn't come home. Oh, they may have seen him arrested. And if he was in the household, he was like every other father. So, you know, there was good and bad and liked and disliked. But the kids, you know, kids, they're very attached to their parents. And the rupture of that relationship in this traumatic way, and it happens again and again. I did a small study in Connecticut, actually, in Hartford, which looked at the group of people who were in jail, come out of jail, or on probation. It was a big sample. We looked at how much time, if they had a kid, and about two-thirds of the people in prison, the adults in prison, do have children. So there are almost twice as many children affected by imprisonment as the individuals themselves. And we saw that because of the recurrent nature of it, once someone goes to prison, they go back again and again. And if you look at that happening, and it starts happening typically in the point in life, let's say late teens, early 20s, when people have their first kid, and then they're out and they may have another kid. And they go back in again and they come out and they may have another kid. So these children of this population experience half their childhood absent a parent because of incarceration. And then when they're not incarcerated, they're on parole and probation in restrictive ways that limit their ability to have a relationship with their own children. There's even a law related to adoption in the name of permanency that if a parent has been separated from their child for 15 months, I think it is, under this federal law, that begins an automatic process for permanent termination of parental rights without the parent even able to know about them because they're often in jail when this procedure is going forward, and the child is permanently severed from their parent in that way. They lose all rights to them. And then when they go into these adoptive homes, frequently they're foster homes, not necessarily adoptive homes. It doesn't mean the kids don't get abused there and don't have parents there who use drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So if it wasn't so vast, you would just say, well, this is another one of those things that doesn't work very, very well in this country. But you have to understand the scale of it. There are 67 million American adults who have a criminal record right now. That means fingerprints. They might have been arrested and found not guilty or the charges dropped. But once those fingerprints get into the system and you've been arrested, companies like Walmart, for example, won't hire you to sweep the floor. because you have this record. They can hire people who haven't been in prison. Obviously, you're not going to get a job in daycare or driving a school bus or anything like that. Never had a record. And when I tell you 67 million Americans have criminal records now, it's mind-boggling.
If these people were in a court of law and the judge was saying, okay, first we're going to take away this from you, then you're going to lose your kids, and then the punishment is going to be you won't be able to vote, and then furthermore, your whole community will be affected through loss of income across the board, you and your neighbors. I mean, obviously, the jury would look at him and say, what? But that is the result, right?
There's a piece in the New York Times today about the fact that very few cases go to trial anymore, that the methods that prosecutors use to get plea bargains out of clients now, the inadequacy of public defense, how that's been cut back, means that it's over 97% of people charged in crimes get sentenced to them. So the process begins, because once you're in the system, as I said, it's like a chronic infectious disease that stays with you. And that system, number one, you don't have appeal to a jury who might be willing to take mitigating circumstances into account. And frequently, the laws that prescribe a sentence for, let's say, having an ounce of cocaine are mandatory. Judges have lost a lot of discretion in this, the mandatory sentencing. So the whole thing becomes kind of a machine in which you're caught up and are really quite helpless. The way it works is that the threat of the case discussed in the Times story today of prosecutors, if you're facing 2 years in prison now, if you plead guilty to something you didn't do, but the evidence looks like you did, and then you're threatened with a charge that might carry 50 years in prison. If you want to go to trial with it, you take your chances. So even defense attorneys, public defenders who are trying to make the best deal for their clients often recommend they plead guilty. So the whole system works in this very mechanistic way at this point. But if you look back at who the people actually are, first of all, there are so many of them, 10 times as many as there were 30 years ago, and Americans aren't 10 times as bad as they were 30 years ago by any measure I can think of, you still get caught up in it, and then it takes on a life of its own. The money is a very big issue because it's very expensive to play this game. Probably $500 billion a year in the country is being spent on incarceration, arrest, the detention, probation, parole, the court system that processes these people. That's not even taking into account the lost productivity associated with it being unable to work. And that money comes out of exactly the other things that we care about the most, schools, health care, care for the elderly. We have a situation in New York, it must be true elsewhere, but it's been done most in New York, looking at the economic impact in communities where have very high rates of arrest and incarceration in Brooklyn and Harlem and South Bronx. And my friend Eric Cadora, who runs something called the Justice Mapping Project, has documented that there are blocks now in New York City which spend $3 to $5 million per year on locking up people from one building, a high-rise housing project, let's say, which we have everywhere in the country. You'll have so many people in prison from that block that $3 to $5 million is being spent. Now imagine what that money would buy in the way of social services, health care, education, old age assistance, you name it, improvements to the community. For one block, that's 50, 60 people that could work on one block, which has a few thousand people in it. So, and especially now where the money is being squeezed so tight, it's either or. And this is a system that doesn't let go very easily. There have been prisons closed in upstate New York that are still staffed, because the people who work in them can't get jobs anywhere else, and they have a lot of power with their state legislators. There's a very famous book called Crime Control as Industry, written by a Norwegian criminologist named Niels Christie. And it's a very prescient view. It was written 20 years ago. It's a very prescient view of what was going on in the United States. And it doesn't happen this way in other countries that are similar to us, Canada, Australia, Great Britain. They have prison rates one-fifth of ours. Not that they don't have problems. They have similar problems, actually. But they haven't resorted to this thing of locking people up, which is one of the most destructive things you can do to people.
And let me ask, too, about the questions being raised today over the way Wall Street and banks appear to be getting rescued Well, 14 million Americans are out of work and waiting for help. So now you're saying social program money is being cut. I mean, maybe ending mass incarceration does a lot to reverse the crisis we're in, you know, financially.
Absolutely. We changed a few laws in New York State in the last 2 years, removing some of the mandatory sentences for nonviolent felony offenses. Four categories. This is after 30 years of struggle to get these things changed. In the first year alone, we averted 1,400 imprisonments in New York State, and at a minimum of $40,000 per year per imprisonment. Do the math. That's about $56 million.
And what about cases like Troy Davis, where Georgia carried out an execution, you know, in spite of widespread opposition and the belief that he was innocent?
Right. No, we all saw that case. It breaks your heart. The question is really, why couldn't they wait? You know, clearly with the reversals of the testimony that had convicted him in the first place, people, 7 out of 9 witnesses recanted their testimony. They've been coerced by the police. Why they couldn't step back and say a new trial or let's review the case. As soon as the Supreme Court had refused to hear it, they killed him within an hour. Very frightening. I don't know if you saw that debate with Rick Perry where Brian Williams brought up the matter of 234 executions under his governorship. And before Perry could say, I didn't lose any sleep over it, the audience started applauding. And that was a Tea Party audience. But it was kind of a bloodlust. It was very, very frightening to hear. And then a moment later, they asked a question about someone who didn't have health insurance, hadn't chosen to buy health insurance. What if they get sick? We just let them die. And so 4 people shouted out from the audience, yeah, let them die. Capital punishment normally isn't linked to mass incarceration for drugs. But in fact, they're part of the same continuum. And to my mind, it has to do with a very punitive, retributive kind of attitude in this country and the part of some people now, which goes a step beyond the lack of compassion, saying it's not my responsibility to look after people. We're coming to another test of it now with the FEMA money, which is run out for the relief from these terrible storms that, you know, you guys have had in Connecticut and we've had around the country. Why isn't there money there for that? Well, a lot of it's going to lock people up. And when there isn't enough to go around, you know, the priorities are set by, there's no cap on prison spending. I've never seen a cap on prison spending anywhere. It always comes out of something else. California, a very dramatic case. It used to have the best public school system in the country, you know, culminating in Berkeley and UCLA and those places. Now it has one of the worst. So, we're in a trap of our own invention at this point. The linkage to real problems is, it's not that I ran a drug program for 20 years in the Bronx, but I know about drug problems that real people have. And Lord knows they need help. And in fact, we have very good treatment for drug problems now, actually. But there's hardly any money for them because it all goes into locking drug users up.
What we really are facing, too, is this privatization trap as well, where the reason we're seeing more or less robo-signing in the courts is that it serves the interests of corporations, on the one hand, that run this prison industry, while on the other hand, we see many pharmaceutical companies profiting greatly from the sale of drugs. And I mean, it's in a way you could argue that the nation is addicted to drugs, right?
Well, definitely. And, you know, we will see a shift. It's already happening. And the worst thing that can happen to you with drugs is that you die from overdose. And the overdose rate has tripled in the last 15 years in the United States. And most of that increase is not illicit drugs. It's illicit pharmaceuticals that are being used outside of medical practice. Drugs like OxyContin. I think the principal thing is to recognize that locking people up, if it's not clearly a reason for, say, someone who will do harm to others or themselves by being out, that was always the concept of incarceration. And that's not justifiable in the case of these low-level drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses, and yet they are the kindling that fuels the system and keeps it going. But they come out. There's a book called But They All Come Home. And the but is important because people don't think for a moment that if someone goes off to prison, they're out of sight, out of mind as far as the general public is concerned. And it doesn't occur to people that what happens in prison and what kind of transformations take place for the person who's been in prison, how that affects their family, that that's a real issue, but they all come home. So that coming home is a very consequential thing. Right now, over 600,000 people come out of prison each year. Another 600,000 go in. But those who come out go back to a world in which they can barely function. They've been stigmatized. They've lost the right to do many things, certain kind of jobs, to get licenses, to vote. So we've talked about this before. And we need to start with those people. So there's the front door and the back door. There's the back door of people coming out. And we need to begin to have a kind of work. I don't mean therapy and jobs. Obviously, you need that too. But there needs to be something that's a little more conscious of what's gone on here. And it's more like a civil war where we've established a conflict between a very large number of people and others in their own communities. That's very much like a civil war. And I think what we need to do is to begin to adopt the kind of truth and reconciliation processes that we heard about in South Africa and are going on in Rwanda now, places with the most awful kind of divisions in communities, people killing each other genocidally in Rwanda, and yet they're now expected to work it out, to learn that we all have to live together, even though what they did is so awful. They're back, they're part of the country, and we have to do that somehow. And now what most of the prisoners have done is not so awful, really. And it's not necessary to punish them in this way. But once you do and they come out, someone needs to reverse that damage. And I think that can only happen at the community level. I think churches and community organizations have to begin to open up. They call them out in the West, where a lot of Native Americans are involved. They call them healing circles. But to have a healing process which can enable people who have been through this awful system to reintegrate into their homes, families, communities. And that needs to become a model here. At the end, the front door of the system going in, we already know by taking away imprisonment for low-level drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses, that alone would eliminate 400,000 people a year going into prison in the United States. So between those two things, and you get conscientious about them, you're going to begin to shrink this system and reduce the damage it does.
Professor Ernest Drucker, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Clinical psychologist Professor Ernest Drucker is author of the new book, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. He is professor emeritus in the Department of Family and Social Medicine at the Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's also scholar in residence at John Jay College of Criminal Justice of City University of New York and on the teaching faculty of the Bard Prison Initiative. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.
In 2012, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote this claim in the majority opinion in the case Arizona versus United States. In the state's most populous county, these aliens are reported to be responsible for a disproportionate share of serious crime.
The bill I'm about to sign into law, Senate Bill 1070, represents another tool for our state to use as we work to solve a crisis.
The Supreme Court was ruling on the constitutionality of Arizona's Senate Bill 1070, a strict immigration law that requires police officers to verify citizenship status of all people they detain or arrest. ProPublica traced Kennedy's claims back to its source, and we found that Kennedy's numbers didn't add up. To back up his claim, Kennedy cited a report from the Center for Immigration Studies, a nonprofit that advocates for reducing immigration. Kennedy described the report as, quote, estimating that unauthorized aliens comprise 8.9% of the population and are responsible for 21.8% of the felonies in Maricopa County. The figure about felonies came from a study published by Maricopa County Attorney Andrew Thomas, using data from 2007. He was elected on a broad anti-illegal immigration agenda.
Illegal immigration is a brutal battle that Andrew Thomas understands. He has led the charge against human smugglers.
But the Center for Immigration Studies got the number wrong. The study claims 21.8% is an estimate. But the actual analysis of the data shows undocumented immigrants were responsible for 18.7% of felony convictions in the county, not 21.8%. To be clear, the 18.7% figure is still disproportionately high compared to undocumented immigrants' share of the population. But there are even more problems with this data. Thomas, the county's attorney, pursued felony convictions against undocumented immigrants for three specific crimes that are tied to being in the U.S. illegally.
I had an informal policy. I called it, half-jokingly, the Thomas No Amnesty policy, which was I required that they get a felony conviction.
First, Thomas prosecuted undocumented immigrants being smuggled into the U.S. as co-conspirators. So people that were previously treated as crime victims were now charged with a felony. Almost all smuggling cases Thomas prosecuted were against undocumented immigrants. And no other county attorney in Arizona prosecuted smuggled immigrants this way. Second, Thomas aggressively prosecuted immigrants who committed criminal impersonation. For example, putting a fake social security number on a job application. Third, Thomas also aggressively prosecuted forgery, like fake identification cards. And again, Thomas ran for office on an anti-immigrant platform. So it's no surprise he aggressively prosecuted three nonviolent crimes that are most often committed by undocumented immigrants as they attempt to enter or work in the U.S. If we remove these three crimes from the analysis, we find undocumented immigrants made up 13.8% of all felony convictions in Maricopa County in 2007. It's still more than their share of the population, but significantly less than the 21.8 number Kennedy cited in the Supreme Court's ruling. Oh, also, we should note that Thomas was disbarred by the state of Arizona 5 weeks before the release of the court's ruling. In its documentation, the Arizona State Bar alleged Thomas committed 32 ethical violations as the attorney for Maricopa County. The Supreme Court's ruling in Arizona versus the United States set a broad precedent for future cases about immigration enforcement by local police. Yet, the math didn't add up, and nobody bothered to check.
I'm asking a question, and if you don't, you're not answering the question.
You came very aggressively.
No, I asked who you were with.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you ain't got it on camera. I'm asking you who you're with. Are you with Tommy Robinson or against them?
We're journalists.
So who are you with? What is your organisation?
We're with Al Jazeera.
Oh, okay.
And we do not have any sides of anything.
Okay, well, then you're Muslim back then, aren't you? You're Muslim backed.
What does that mean?
Well, you fucking stupid. Are you thick?
Oh, well, explain to me because you're so intelligent, apparently.
You know what? You're a slag.
Thank you, sir.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed. Tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
It's our news flash.
Hello, I'm Rick Harp. This is Media Indigenous, episode 131. On this week's Indigenous Roundtable, has a controversial pipeline now become a pipe dream? Canada's Federal Court of Appeal has ruled that expansion plans for Trans Mountain are to be put on hold until the government gets its act together. At issue for the court, two main concerns. Number one, the failure to take into account the impact.